section is on ethic issues. And our first speaker is Julius Floyd, who is professor of philosophy at Boston University. Enfin, la présentation ça devrait être en français, donc je vais faire un switch au français. Après le talk, ça sera quand même en anglais. Donc Juliette Floyd, c'est professeure de philosophie à l'université de Boston. Elle a travaillé sur la philosophie de la science et sur l'histoire de la philosophie analytique. Elle a fait des travaux très importants sur Wittgenstein et la mathématique, et en particulier un travail avec aussi Hilary Putnam sur la lecture de Wittgenstein du théorème de Gödel. Et elle a aussi travaillé sur Alan Turing. Et en fait, Wittgenstein et Turing vont être aussi part de l'exposé qu'elle va nous faire. Donc, merci Juliette pour avoir accepté notre invitation. Merci beaucoup.
Merci. Je peux prendre les questions après en français, mais je vais parler en anglais parce que Sarah m'a dit que c'était meilleur pour moi de faire ça. Alors, merci bien pour l'invitation. I'm very happy to be here. And very grateful to Maurizio and to Jim for allowing me to be at this wonderful conference at a global institute devoted to bringing philosophers together with sociologists and people who actually are interested in philosophy of law and media studies. So this is a new venture for me, and Maurizio's presence at a conference 3 years ago in Jim's new division of emerging media was a really important contribution and got me thinking very hard actually about Turing and Wittgenstein in a new kind of way. So total mobilization and documentality are moments, I would say, in my overall conception of what was going on with this history. So today I'm going to talk about things that may seem very unconnected with social media and immediate things that people are doing with phones, but to me they're very connected. And it's very important to me that, can everyone see the slides? Maybe I turn the light down. Okay, so maybe I'll begin just by again thanking Maurizio, and I'll pass this book around if people haven't seen it. It emerged from the conference that they ran. Oxford Press took the book in a moment because in the American context, we do not have that many philosophers weighing in on the brave new world that we live in. I happen to think it's very important for many reasons. We're in a kind of floating world, I would say. Like we're in Japan or something. So I hope you don't get seasick. But the seas of language, as Wittgenstein said, often run high. Anyway, for me, the issues of Turing and Wittgenstein are very connected because it was issues in the foundations of logic, the foundations of mathematics, that actually led to the building of the Turing machine. Most people do not realize that it was a conceptual advance and a philosophical advance of a very profound kind. And that this enabled Turing to visualize and see 50, 60 years ahead what would be. So I think it's important for philosophy to claim its place. I also think it's important for philosophy to enter the conversation now. And we don't really know, I think, what this is going to be. So it's an interesting chance and lovely for me to know Maurizio and talk to Jim, who actually knows something about what people actually do because he does sociological surveys. Having predicted the ubiquitous use of the cell phone, other such things. So the plan here is first to make a few comments about Maurizio's book, Documentality as a Concept. Then I will step in on behalf of the American pragmatist tradition. My reading of Wittgenstein is very saturated with this. I'll talk a bit about Hilary Putnam's idea of semantic externalism, which I think solidified certain ideas of Quine's and brought them to fruition during the 1970s, 80s. Then I'll talk a bit about Wittgenstein and following a rule. I'll return to the issue of voice because, of course, we are in France. We must remember Derrida. We must think about the metaphysics of presence, but we must also think about voice. So Stanley Cavell will be my post-Quinean advocate for that. And then I'll say a few things about Turing and the need for imagination because this came up this morning. It's very difficult, actually, to picture what a Turing machine is. And the imagination colors our picture, even of what this conceptual construct is. And I think this is very important history that everyone in every field should know. So I'll go back to the history at the end. Three theses of Maurizio's, as I guess we all know. Society is not based on communication, but on recording. We can imagine a society without language, but not a society without memory. Now, of course, as a student of Wittgenstein, I'm a little concerned about what a society without language would be. But this could be discussed in the context of what we mean by a society without language. Two, the production of documents manifests the centrality of recording. And of course, with total mobilization, the massive cheapness of collecting data, it's all growing exponentially. Third, normativity. Human beings, says Maurizio, are primarily passive receptors of rules manifested through documents. We are not intentional producers of values. Values are socially dependent and socially constructed. This is the moment of passivity to which I think Jim was responding with the notion of interpretation. So I will be coming back to that idea of interpretation. I particularly relished Maurizio's critique of Searle, who has made important contributions to thinking about collective action, but whose psychologism is, I think, worrisome, coming out of his particular understanding of the speech act tradition. Typically, says Maurizio, it's not Searle's body, including his intention, that makes him a professor, a husband, an employee of the state of California, and the holder of a driver's license. It's a series of documents. So the touchstone of writing and what is exterior to psychological intention is very important. But I would emphasize, as part of the notion of documentality, logic, which is in the background all the time. And it isn't just a series of documents. It's a series of documents used by us and designed by us. So here, I think the idea of interpretation, framing, positioning, how the words are used is crucial to meaning. And here we get to Putnam, someone from whom Maurizio has learned, and in fact cites Putnam as part of his manifesto of the New Realism. Putnam, importantly, was the person who founded functionalism, a picture of a Turing machine as a reductive computationalist psychology, at least for empirical concepts, when he was at MIT in the early 60s. And the process of coming by the early 70s to see semantic externalism, the idea that meanings are not in the head, there is a division of linguistic labor, and after Quine's attack on the purely conceptual versus empirical, the analytic and the synthetic, we need to see a dynamic interaction between our modes of dividing and classifying in the world and the notion of being real. So I think this goes beyond what Searle is doing with intention. I think it is a much more dynamic and interesting and significant picture of meaning, and solidifies in particular the insights of Quine, although Putnam, unlike Quine, didn't want ontology to be something that was essentially schematic. Putnam really cared about truth. So documentality, like information, like interpretation, does not include truth. But somewhere, the notion of truth is there. Okay, so for Putnam and semantic externalism, there is a division of linguistic labor. I know that the words elm and beach have different references, but I don't have visible criteria by means of which I could verify that difference. I rely on experts. I rely on expertise and the faith that ultimately this institution will carry us along. It's part of a picture of logic and of truth that is Lamarckian, not Darwinian. Pragmatism is deeply embedded in the history of absorbing Darwinian picture of societal evolution. But I think in Putnam's case, the pragmatism went one step further. There's no dichotomy between facts and values. We might think we could peel off the fact and take away the value, and in local circumstances we can do this. But globally, there is an all-permeating question of value. So values like truth, reference, meaning, understanding, all the philosophical concepts, it's like the giraffe's neck, according to Lamarck, which became long only because the giraffe in each generation had to reach up as an individual and eat the leaves. Some of our notions are like this. They are not driven by ultimately random variation. Now, what's happening is that words are part of reality, and then as we type those words, We change the types and we change the reality. So there's a seamlessness here. This is a dynamic picture of logic, way beyond where logic was, I would say, through Frege, perhaps through Gödel. It's a new way. Maurizio's book has the following claim, which is, I think, very interesting. The web collapses the distinctions between structure and superstructure, and between public and private, and between private life and work. I think this is absolutely right. We no longer can live with certain kinds of dichotomies in philosophy that we took to be foundational dichotomies, and we need to update those ideas. The notion of the a priori, for example, the revisable a priori. There are unthinkables, as Putnam would say. There always are things that are outside the limits of what we think, but we should not be so proud as to think something might not happen that might radically change our framework of unthinkables. What I would say in a Wittgensteinian pragmatist spirit is our ways of drawing these distinctions between superstructure and structure, between ideas and realities, public and private, all have real-world implications, and it is up to us to draw these intelligently against a dynamic and evolving backdrop. Critique, discussion, and design will and should go on. So this, too, is part of the pragmatist's tradition of ideas and words as tools. Humans are, in fact, using technology to create and intensify certain kinds of face-to-face social interactions and discussions. And I think that in our worries about privacy and surveillance, we must also remember what people are actually doing. As Maurizio says, they are voluntarily doing these things. They are seeking recognition. And I'm quite obsessed with Tinder now. I think it's a fantastic thing to explore how different generations might use Tinder as hookup culture, or as a way to pass if you're gay and experimenting. Or now, among younger people, it's really a way to create, in a situation where people have very little free time economically, a quick way to have a safe space to talk. That's interesting. Also, there's Black Lives Matter, so I'll come back to that. We offload procedures, computations, step-by-step, effective command structures. We do that in order to interface with one another. And the interface is not a place. It's not a point. It's not an in-principle stopping point. It's a dynamic, evolving point that is a feature of how we all look at one another and hide pieces of one another. Even so, an example here is the, I mentioned earlier, are these noble attempts to pressure governments to allow open data initiatives. We all want transparency. We all want the government to be accountable. But with the public release of information by municipalities, data algorithm machines are capable of reconstructing incredibly private facts about people. And while local government, and I go back to Olivier's comments of this morning, the flattening out of culture, the lack of attention to how deeply embedded different languages are in culture, is an extremely worrisome aspect of, let's say, English becoming the lingua franca. It's got a lot of implications. We want to worry about that, but the release of public information is also a danger. So how we even have transparency about what is going on requires a lot of careful thought, and unintended consequences of legislation will be the norm. We have to face that fact, that our concepts are, as pragmatic tools, in some sense experimental, even on the a priori margins. So these institutions and processes of governance, I think, must be reformed through some kind of public discussion, and we don't know how to do that very well right now. I think we need to admit that, and admit that a lot of imagination and engineering of concepts and modes of speech act need to be rethought all the way down. On the other hand, also, algorithms aggregate data and can extract all sorts of private information and allow surveillance, but they can also be designed to disaggregate. So the algorithms are helpful at hiding information, anonymizing, and I think the issue of anonymity and inclusion is very, very important. Many people are able to share their vulnerabilities on the web, talk through avatars in ways that they otherwise would not be included. So degrees of anonymization are important, and the algorithms themselves can be designed to help that. But my main point is, of course, the end user. We have a say. We have to understand that. So it's not that the documents somehow interpret themselves. The ultimate point, I think, is a Wittgenstein point. It's procedures and activities of speech, not merely documentation, however important it is to the notion of an algorithm that you must write it down. You see, you don't have the algorithm until you document it in a step-by-step fashion, but nevertheless, where you start with the algorithm, your choice of where you start, your choice of your simple points of analysis is always open to contestation. So the rule, the document, does not apply itself at each step. Instead, we begin the routine somewhere, we take something to be the starting point, to be the simple, and we proceed. Any particular place we begin, we take something to be simple. Any such step of taking something to be simple might be contested. It's really a point from Plato's Theaetetus about knowledge and perception. It's really about the step to find a starting point. And it's true that some rules we follow blindly. Our eyes, as Wittgenstein says, my eyes are shut. But that's for the sake of discussing and doing other different things. What we rely on are harmonies, a musical analogy, an analogy involving the notion of Stimme or voice. These require activity, and I would say they are not passively given any more than the harmony of a choir is passively given. It's something you have to work at to keep going. Now, here I go to the notion of voice, and of course, for me, Stanley Cavell is the philosopher of voice and of recognition of his generation. The claim here would be that the problem of other minds is much more fundamental to people than the problem of the external world or the problem of virtual versus real. Why? It's a Rousseauian point. Everybody wants to be known and acknowledged by another free being for who we are. You want to be someone, but you can't be someone unless that moment of recognition is there and being recognized by someone who also has some sense of amour propre. In Rousseau's sense, I take amour propre not to be a neutral force. Sometimes Rousseau is read this way by economists. It is the source of inequality, but amour propre is also a force of good. So what we need to think about, I think, when we think about privacy is the need people have for private sociability, safe spaces where they can try on new dimensions of self and feel safe and yet come to be recognized. And I think that's very connected with this idea of having a voice, feeling that your voice will be heard. You know, and there are many causes for mass shootings, not least of which is lack of gun legislation in the United States. But in many cases, the perpetrators are people who want to be known, and they feel they're not being acknowledged as individuals in the world around them. So I think if we look at use of social technology, at the uses of Tinder, apps that are trying to construct safe spaces for people, we see what's really driving people. They are worried about surveillance. They are worried about privacy. But they're also worried about not being known in the way they want to be known. So I'm going to briefly stop with, I don't know how much time I have because we started with, but anyway, Enrico, you'll tell me if I go over. So this is my historical philosoph, 20 minutes, 10 minutes, that's fine. So I just want to talk about how difficult it is actually to imagine what a Turing machine is. We throw this word around, but actually the thing about it is you can't picture it. It's sort of something you have to grasp conceptually. This is, of course, a duck rabbit. It happens to be in a park in Göttingen, right near where certain famous mathematicians are buried, so I particularly like that one. The usual picture you get of a Turing machine embodies perfectly Maurizio's concept of documentality. All of these pictures are taken out of textbooks. You have a scanner on a tape. You have zeros and ones. You have some kind of procedure that it computes. You see what the procedure is from outside the machine. The machine is a mathematical object. It's really a collection of quintuples. But when we think the dynamic quality of the computation into the machine, and it's very important that Turing's model conceptually has both a dynamic and a static quality. However, we look at this thing, and I remember Hillary Putnam's critique of functionalism. Who's watching the tape, right? Where's the society? So this is an abstraction that you could choose to teach students, and it has its documentality moment, but it's not the only way of thinking about a Turing machine. What Turing actually did in his famous paper on computable numbers was to clarify the notion of a formal system in the mathematical logician sense by comparing it to the actions of a human being. Now, no one in the Hilbert school, Gödel, they never would have done it. The only reason Turing did it was he'd studied with Wittgenstein and he had read the Blue Book. Because what he realized is you have to make really fundamental to logic the idea of a human being writing down a recipe for a step-by-step routine. And you have to write it down. This is the documentality moment. But the entire Turing machine as a construct is based on an analogy. It's what Wittgenstein called an object of comparison. It's all an analogy, but the analogy is with us. You see, if you want to clarify what a relevant sense of a formalism is, a logical formalism, you cannot write another one down. If you just write another one down, you haven't clarified what it is you wanted to do. So you have to do something different. And what Turing did was to create an analogy. So the whole thing is based, in that sense, on imagination, the whole thing. What he was really thinking about, of course, was, this is an image of the central post office in London. He was really thinking of a social setting, not of some isolated tape in the brain. He was thinking of all the labor that these poor people are doing. And he was thinking of a computation as something one human being does and can pass off to another one when they get tired. So the whole thing is taking place already in a kind of social setting where there's a group activity envisaged. Here from Bletchley Park, the Colossus, a realization concretely of the Turing machine, and you see he's offloaded huge numbers of computations through probabilistic algorithms that are embodied in these wires. Now there are only two women and a massive increase in what could be offloaded, gotten out of the human activity. So it's an increase in power. But you're doing this for a purpose, right? In this case, you're doing it to break the Enigma code. Because, another Wittgenstein point, another Turing point, no code is unbreakable. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a code for something we can understand. So the offloading is what goes on. Now, this is a picture, a typical picture from a textbook of a Turing machine that students are used. Where's the human? Here we have what I think Maurizio might call the system of documentality concretized. So here the imagined thing is a black box. We have no idea, it's the behaviorist picture of Turing. We have no idea what's in there. We just know that it moves along the track in various pieces, but we can't get inside of it, right? So to me, it's an embodiment of the Cavellian problem of other minds, just in the textbooks that they're teaching Turing. Here's one from Bulos and Jeffrey's textbook. Here they've sort of put a little man inside because they want to have the idea that a computational routine is somehow a worker. But it's a dotted line, so it's very odd. They're kind of unclear that it couldn't be a little homunculus really in there, because then we'd have all sorts of problems. But we still have to think of the human. So I don't know who did this. Maybe George Bulos did it. You kind of put that in there and take it back. But really, I mean, Turing talked about, in later papers, the idea of a cultural search. We're searching together. I mean, I don't know what these people are doing, but they seem to be having a good time together. And they're looking at one another and their machines and enjoying what they're looking at. So again, the cultural setting of the search, Turing was very clear. Infallible thinking is out. There's no such thing as a general decision procedure for truth. So we were always experimenting in terms of a cultural search. Finally, I'll just end on this with voice. Here's a picture of women marching for Black Lives Matter. They're using cell phones to video, even in real time, police abuse. This is having a massive impact on people's feelings about inequalities in the cities. And we don't know how effective this is going to be, but again, I would emphasize it's the user end that has to be taken into account when we talk about the use of these algorithms. An algorithm doesn't interpret itself. It's something that realizes concretely a routine that we have decided we will offload somewhere else so that we presumably can have the leisure to talk and do other things. So I think I'll end there, and thank you all very much.
Thank you very much. My first question will be an answer to the question, what could be a society without a speech, without language. But my idea is that there are the most of social actions can be done without language, but not without memory. I mean, I can marry myself without language. I can buy a ticket without language. But without memory, I will have memory inscribed in the ticket or memory inscribed in the documents or in the on the mind of the witnesses. There will be no such an object like a marriage or a ticket. This, of course, I believe that a society without language would be very ugly and boring, nonetheless, could be something like this. Whereas it was, of course, a reductio ad absurdum. We can conceive a science fiction writer can conceive a society without language, but cannot conceive a society without memory, because a completely amnesic society is not a society. People do not recognize each other, makes rules, and so on. In a sense, a society without memory could be like a language without code, yes. An absurd in Wittgensteinian terms.
But may I respond to that?
Yes, sure.
So, because this is where the psychologism begins, it seems to me, in the picture of memory. I mean, I quite agree that memory would need some kind of embodied procedural way, because we have already to make sense of the idea of having the same thought. I mean, how do I know that I just had the same thought or a different thought? My title includes the word other, so I think identity conditions are really very important here. I mean, how do you know that the letter A that occurs in the first part of that word in the document is the same as the letter A that occurs in the next word? I mean, even having, but then it seems to me that the fundamental thing is the point about stability, which memory concretely realizes in documentation. The point is the stability of a procedure where we can recognize something as the same. And even a marriage, I mean, to count as a marriage, there's a speech act, presumably, right? It's not just the document. If we find out that there wasn't the speech act, at least in my state of Massachusetts, things have to be said with the right intention and so on. These are all Austinian points about stability. So I don't think we get documentality itself for free. No. I think this is a logical point, but I don't mean by logic here, I mean, I mean it almost in the Hegel sense of logic, you understand. I don't mean that logic is a formal system, but I mean that you have to really think through same and other all the way down, and the documents don't interpret themselves. Already to get that A is the same letter as A, you've already got to have some system of identity criteria by which to go. And here, of course, I'm just repeating certain elements of Wittgenstein's thought, which I claim he came to, this point about the simples, and I think I can document this, which is important to me. He came to those ideas in 1937 after he read Turing's On Computable Numbers. The later Wittgenstein looks like a very modernist writer with a multilog of voices, that it was some literary preference. No. he knew after he read Turing that he had to write the book that way, because his whole idea of what a simple was now had both an absolute framework, because the notion of computable is an absolute notion in the technical logician sense, that it doesn't vary depending upon the language that you're in. The notion of a procedural step transcends the limitations of a particular language system. And Wittgenstein realized that notion of simplicity is absolute but fluid. And it would hold up all the way, and that's what logic is. So for me, it all has to do with where the procedures start and where we decide to take that step to take something as fundamental. And I quite agree that, for me, documentality is a crucial moment here with mobile technology, because you don't have the algorithm until you can write it down. That's embodied in Turing's picture. But you write it down independently of any particular language, of course. This is why he's clarifying what a particular syntax is, because there's no particular syntax for a Turing machine. It transcends the limitations of language in that sense. But behind it, in the dynamic picture of what we're doing with the algorithm, is always the logical point. It's a very basic point, that you have to take the step and start somewhere. And that is always contestable. It's filled with value judgments, which is why Turing said what we really should do is to make symbolic logic concrete so that no mathematician ever has to learn any of it. Make it invisible. He was like Steve Jobs, you know, put it under the hood. And then we can get on to interface and proceed with what he called the cultural search. So for me, it's a question of a foundational picture, and I really believe the pragmatic Wittgensteinian post-Quinean picture of meaning. You've got to go all the way. You can't think there's one point. There are basic logical reasons why we can't. So I call it the documentality moment, the being Hegelian, I suppose, at heart. And that was really my picture, not the unimportance of documentality, but the importance of stability, harmony, procedures, and how we construct that safe space in which we are willing to keep singing each in our own voice, but keeping something stable.
I don't want to monopolize
the... Yes, you had two questions, though, so...
Yes, because... first, a short commentary. My view is not the opposite or alternative to the view of the speech acts. Simply says, in the analysis of speech acts, curiously, Austin forgot the moment of document, of inscription. This was simply the, and this is a transcendental of the speech act, because the effectiveness about the condition of felicity of the speech act is neither that is written, and he forgotten. Possibly because his favorite example was the marriage. But note that one of the examples of Austin goes without the living present, because he's someone who says, I give this watch to my brother as an inheritance. So the effectiveness, yes. This speech act finds its effectiveness when the speaker is dead. So, he paid not attention to this point, whereas he paid attention to the paradigm of marriage. But there is a given moment in which he says, well, to marry is to say some words. And he makes the example. Well, for instance, Inuit marriage without words, and make all this analysis. But this is only to clarify that this was not a counter analysis of speech acts,
yes.
But is simply adding a single and relevant point to speech acts, which was, in my sense, what Derrida was willing to say in this text, which was too much obscure. Now, I believe the only contribution it was to make a clear 10 pages of Derrida. And the other point is, and this is the question, because in many of your, in many parts of your presentation, maybe I have misunderstood. You say, yes, but who sees the series? Who thinks? And this is a serious argument. Documents alone does not speak. But I would say that also humans alone does not speak. Yes. If you put a human into a wood, he would not speak. He would not. So there is a sense in which, in order to make us as speakers, is needed. Now, this maniac of documentality. We need document, but in fact, we need good manners, education. All this makes it so that one can speak and one make that document or something that are meaningful for us.
Yes, and it's very old, obviously. The oldest records we have of script are taxes, efforts to keep a society with a differential set of social and economic and legal connections stable, because you can fix the words. But, of course, Austin wanted to, he inherited the empiricist tradition, and he was involved in a different kind of critique, of course, than Derrida, which is the old empiricist idea that you have the perception of the color, you have the word for the color, and it's all just going to line up perfectly rationally. So there's a great deal of rationalism about words embedded in the empiricist tradition, coming through Locke with all his ideas about privacy and language, too. Austin is attempting to rid empiricism of these dogmas, just as Quine was trying to do that at about the same time. And therefore, the fundamental notion in Austin and that of a speech act is that of recognition, not in the sense of recognizing you as the same person who was in the room 10 minutes ago, but the sense of recognition coming from a king who recognizes your dominion over a particular area of land. And of course, documents are very important for that too. But the notion of mutual recognition, that we have recognized procedures for doubt, recognized procedures for when words have run out to describe something, recognized procedures, this is very fundamental to what Austin is doing. And so we need both moments. And for me, it's interesting that the Turing machine really embodies both of those moments. Thank you.
It's indeed a classical criticism of the analogy between the human mind and Turing machine.
Yes.
Is, of course, John Searle's Chinese Room.
Yes.
So it seems that especially the picture you showed of the little man into the
yes,
Turing
this
machine
is very bad.
Is very,
very
it reminds
bad.
Me the idea. Well,
it's very
the idea,
bad.
Yes, this is John Searle within the Chinese Room.
Right.
So
very bad. No, I mean it's a very good argument, but it's a very bad picture of Turing.
So it seems
very
that you are about to construct a different argument with the same target. So
yes.
The target is still the mind-machine analogy, but Searle's basically is an internist argument, since it does not need society, it just needs himself
yes.
within the machine, and for him this is sufficient in order to show that
right.
the mind is not the tape,
right.
it's not Turing tape.
So I would
like to stress the difference between
these readings
Searle's
of
argument
Turing.
And your argument.
Yes,
your
you're right, Enrique. I'm offering a very different reading of Turing. Now, Searle's argument is a kind of spelling out to me of Wittgenstein's idea of a language game. I mean, he makes it very vivid and concrete with the Chinese Room. But what he's really doing is thinking up a language game and then working with our intuitions about meaning so that we can see exposed a certain kind of presupposition people might have had about what meaning is. So for me, although Searle might not like this, he's just implementing certain kinds of Wittgensteinian ideas. But in looking at Turing and studying Turing very carefully over the last 3 or 4 years, I'm amazed at how radically misread Turing has been through functionalist eyes and the eyes of those in artificial intelligence who want to build algorithms that, you know, will get a picture of your cognitive structure when it looks at all of the clickings. This is part of surveillance as well, right? The best AI depends upon this belief, desire, intention model, this behaviorist reading of Turing. So it's been very influential, but it can't be what Turing was doing. First of all, you can't prove a mathematical theorem with a theory of mind, right? I mean, he resolved the decision problem of Hilbert. This is a very strong result. Gödel said, it's a miracle. Gödel said, this shows what I was doing, okay? You can't do that in logic with a theory of mind. The word states of mind appears in his paper, but he's very careful there to say it's a comparison to get you to reconceive the whole idea of what taking a step in a formal system really is. So what he's doing is purely philosophical and purely, it also is mathematical. I mean, he has to prove that his conceptual construct can do everything that any particular formal system can do. But it's a conceptual move of a very profound kind. And there is no doubt that what he had in mind, and he makes it clear in that paper, is the shareability, the actionability of a routine. He says explicitly, in calculating a real number, I could stop and hand it off to someone else, and we continue. So the social setting was there. He got the idea from Wittgenstein. Moreover, a final historical point that I'm sort of was happy to discover, if you look at his actual argument in Uncomputable Numbers, the one that resolves the decision problem of Hilbert, that is, I'm sorry, it shows there is no algorithm to show in a finite number of steps, yes or no, a sentence follows from some axiom. So truth is not decidable. If you look at that argument, he builds, people often think in computer science, he uses something called the halting argument, which builds a kind of contradiction from a contrary machine that goes down the diagonal and changes things. That's not what he does. What he does is he constructs a machine whose rule cannot be followed. It's very beautiful. There's no negation there. He was so good at philosophy, he knew he had to take care of systems where negation is rejected by intuitionists. So to have a really general view, he couldn't appeal to negation. So what he does is he builds a machine that has an empty command line, something like you turn up a card in a game that says, do what this card tells you to do. You look at that argument, and it's purely philosophical. He was absolutely aware of what he was doing. He constructs a machine that can't be followed. So a picture of logic itself as purely calculative or procedural, is defeated by something that you look at and you just see you can't do anything with this. Okay, so action lies, in that sense, very deeply at the bottom of documentality. When we talk about the whole idea that we live in a world without decision procedures for many, many important systems of thought. So that's my correction to the behaviorist AI tradition of reading Turing, and I can... I think, map that out, so, yeah. But I think Searle offered a very vivid, nice way of looking at this. It's just that some of the foundational issues about syntax, semantics, what is Chinese, pragmatically, what is it to attribute a thought to someone, what is it to think that I have the same thought I had yesterday, all of those issues are unexplored by that little language game that he builds. Presupposed, and of course, we don't have proofs in philosophy, right? We do in logic, but not in philosophy. There are no proofs. We have arguments and vivid turns of thought that change people's perspectives on what is fundamental. So, yeah.
I have a small follow-up on this, on the Turing test, since it's with respect to your point about acknowledgement and the problem of other people's minds. Seems that the problem of other people's minds is overcome skepticism about other people's minds. It's easier to solve in a context in which you can perceive, like this, in which you can perceive other people. So I have no doubts about your mind, since I see you, I empathize with
perhaps
you.
Perhaps you're overly optimistic.
Well, maybe, but I'm quite, I have some certainty about this, that it seems to lack in a context of communication mediated by the web, for instance, precisely because of a serious interpretation of the Turing test, since it's easier for a not human being, for an algorithm, to simulate to be a human being in a non-perceptual, non-shared context. So
well,
I wonder whether the other people's minds problem can be more serious in a web framework rather than in a common communication framework like this one.
Well, I think, first of all, there are many arguments in Quine and others about our immediate environment of conversation. I mean, I do think you don't get the idea that I have a mind for free. So, and which mind I have, you see, maybe I'm minded, but which particular thought have I thought on this particular occasion, a very serious problem, even face to face. So I'm not quite sure that we should be quite as sanguine about certainty in this kind of context when we begin to really press the point. Now, of course, skepticism about other minds is something, if Cavell's reading of Wittgenstein is right, you cannot refute, you see, because you could always be deceiving me about how you feel right now. In fact, being a person of culture, you learn to do that. You learn to mask how you're feeling inside. So I think all of this is very interesting, both for face-to-face contact and for the web. I think that some of these worries about privacy and law and cybersecurity involve something else, which is we know their minds on the other side. We're not in doubt about that. We just wonder what they're going to be doing. And so we get into secret codes and decrypting information and attempting to hide and reveal information. So I do think there's a separation between these points. But I think the deeper Cavellian point, which is a reading of Wittgenstein that I am persuaded by, is that really the fantasy of a private language is not so much the problem that I have to get to, you know, your particular private qualia sensation and make sure that that's what it is. It's not a verification problem. The problem is that I want to be known. And I want to be known by someone who I find worthy of being known by in the right kind of way. So it's a problem of value as well as of facts. Under this particular reading of the problem of other minds, it's a kind of Rousseauian inheritance of Wittgenstein. So that's what I would say about that. I think also anonymization and hiding of parts of ourselves is very important to inclusion of people in social and democratic contexts. So the need for what I call private sociability, because I think privacy is imbued with all sorts of metaphysical issues. Private sociability, building a safe space, that is part, surely, of what being a citizen in the grand Rousseauian sense, perhaps not of a contract that's documentality. Okay, so I understand, Maurizio, there may not be some grand social contract we'll ever see. But the whole idea of feeling that you are part of a situation in which you can be recognized, if we look at what people are really doing, that's what they really want. That's what they really want, with all the dangers attendant on all of that. So that's not a direct answer to the question, but
thank you. Thank you. Emmanuel?
That was really fascinating material, and I want to read more about your rereading of Turing. That's, of course, a completely different Turing that I've always been used to. And, of course, the question is, Why should we reread Turing? But because, of course, it's not this Turing that was the influential Turing. It was the other one, the misread Turing, mm-hmm. that had an impact on our world. Now, we have various options here. And just to try to synthesize a little bit the discussion also, Maurizio is making a very strong statement. And he's saying, we are facing a world where the main device that is ordering our lives and behaviors is not a computational device, is not a communicational device, it's a recording device. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't do anything doesn't do much beyond, and first, it's if the Turing machine is something, it's a universal recording machine. That's his his statement as I read it. Mm-hmm. Now, we have what I would call the standard Turing reading, where the universal machine is a universal computational machine. Mm-hmm. You seem to suggest the third reading, mm-hmm. and that would be, I don't have the precise name for it, but has clearly to do with invention, with imagination, with mm-hmm. sociability, mm-hmm. and somehow it seems to have to do something with meaning. Yes. Meaning is important to you.
Indeed.
So it seems to me like both in the standard Turing version and in the Maurizio version of it, we don't need the category of meaning. We don't have any distinction between what is meaningful and meaningless. Spam doesn't make any difference whether you process spam or any on love letter or whatever. So why is meaning important? And why do you think, could you mark the difference with respect to this, what do you call the recording moment, which I think Maurizio would not agree that it's only mm-hmm. a moment. Mm-hmm. Where does meaning come in? And why can we have that with a machine?
So, very good. It is a third reading that I'm working out. I mean, it's a Wittgensteinian reading of Turing because historically they had a mutual impact on one another that I think is very fundamental for thinking about things. I earlier used the notion of a type. So it would be the Wittgensteinian idea that information, words, language come to us immediately typed without reflection. Now, we can pick them apart and begin to subject them to alternative routines of analysis and break them apart and change them. But meaning is right there in front of us. It's not some kind of mysterious platonic thing up there in absolute space or something. I mean, the real project of the pragmatic tradition of people like Putnam and Cavell following Quine is to reconstruct the traditional notions of meaning from a different point of view, where we are relative to one another in a pragmatic setting. Now, the whole picture of evolution is very important to this pragmatic picture, rather than the static moment of documentality. And the cultural search is part of this, because what Turing said was, gee, what we should do is, we should go through, he had a paper called The Reform of Mathematical Notation that he wrote in 1944, and he said, I got the idea from Wittgenstein. He said, we ought to go through all the mathematical textbooks in the world and look at how people are actually talking. What are the ideas that the engineers are doing? And then we should pull those out, and we should use logic to offload all the procedural elements so that we can go even farther together. So, he is a design thinker. He is someone who was working at such a grand level of generality that it's very easy to miss, I think, this more dynamic philosophical side of Turing, who was extremely sophisticated. I mean, it really wasn't just about the Turing test. It's about the foundations of logic. And logic is hard, okay? You can't go against logic. So this is the third reading that I'm suggesting, that even the notion of documentality, which is a moment of logic, that is the Wittgensteinian picture of logic, is operational. This was his reaction to Frege and Russell. The basic moment is an operational, we start somewhere and we iterate, and the Tractatus is filled with this, and he insisted always that this is fundamental. But what shifted in reaction to Turing, I believe, in 1937, when Wittgenstein began writing in his later style, the Blue Book and the Brown Book are not like this. They're anthropological. They have the notion of a language game. They do not have the multilog of voices. This Wittgenstein understood from Turing, that the fluidity of simplicity is what logic is, that we take a procedure and we have to start from where we are, and we go from there. And we attach ourselves using every level of meaning we need in order to start that kind of process. So, of course, some of it is passive. He suggested we go through the textbooks and see what other people have come up with. But it's really about the pushing forward of civilization through procedures that allow us to offload things that are messy, that get in the way, that get between us. So this whole idea of making invisible the means of procedure that is certainly a feature of the smartphone that makes it very special, right? That we're massively connected and we see nothing. It's a design point. But it's also a point about what logic is and the centrality of this dialectic between human procedure code is law. Isn't that Larry Lessig's book, right? Law is code, and we will have to write code in order to, you know, alter the code. Law is code, but everywhere it's typed. You have to start there, because you'll never get back to it if you don't start there. I mean, that would be one kind of idea. So it is a third reading, a non-behavioristic reading of Turing as a more pragmatic language game-oriented people. And I guess I think this notion of language game belongs also to logic. So we set up simplified routines for a particular purpose to shed light on certain aspects of meaning. And that will then augment through reflection our ability to imagine other possibilities and other scenarios. So that is the third reading of Turing. It's a reading that makes possibility rather than actuality very central to what Turing and Wittgenstein were doing. So a famous line from Wittgenstein is, form is the possibility of structure, right? So one structure might, I might say the cup is on the table and write that down. But it's another thing to see the possibilities of what could have been said. That's part of my saying that the cup is on the table, and that belongs to logic in this sense. So the idea of possibility spaces and design thinking, where ease of use, immediacy, and simplicity are values, almost aesthetic values, in fact, in the design of software, I think I take that very seriously. So these I would perhaps add to the moment of documentality.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.